Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in Intellectual History. Today I'm speaking with Samuel Moy, Chancellor Kent Professor of Law and History at Yale University, about his new book, Liberalism Against Itself, Cold War Intellectuals and the Making of Our Times. There are few scholars today who write with the same lucidity and dexterity as Sam. Liberalism Against Itself is yet another brilliant entry into his bibliography. At center stage appears Cold War liberalism, one of the dominant Western ideologies appearing in the post-World War II era. Cold War liberals like Isaiah Berlin, Gertrude Himmelfarb, and Karl Popper refashioned liberalism, severing it from its emancipatory roots. Through a series of highly focused intellectual biographies, Sam examines how liberalism is transformed, paving the way for successor ideologies like neoliberalism and neoconservatism. Sam, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
I absolutely loved reading every second of it. And, you know, I think just before jumping into the contents of the book, because there's so much to talk about, I was wondering if you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I am from Missouri, and I went to college there where I was exposed by my teachers to intellectual history. And through a series of, you know, fortunate or unfortunate events, I ended up a law professor. But I got the opportunity to give some lectures at the University of Oxford in a series on the history of political thought. So it was, you know, an opportunity for me to kind of do what I always wanted to do, which was explore the intellectual history of the 20th century. And I defiantly ignored law as a topic and, you know, picked out an era I hadn't much worked on, because I'd written a dissertation more about the earlier period and have written most of my later writings, especially about human rights and so forth, about a later period. And yet this period right after World War II really kind of was calling to me. And so I thought, given the absence of any book about Cold War liberalism that I knew about, I would try to kind of take a stab at capturing the spirit of that movement.
So you begin the book by discussing the work of Judith Sklar, who is really such a fascinating person who I feel like her ideas are very under-discussed, especially compared to some of the other people that you profile in this book. But you really look at her book After Utopia, published in 1957. And, you know, what is it about this book that drew so much to it? You constantly return to the ideas that she deals with in this book. So if you could talk about this book and how it relates to Cold War liberalism more broadly.
So Sklar is maybe renowned in, you know, restricted circles for her own rather brilliant version of Cold War liberalism, epitomized by an essay she wrote a few years before she died in the last year of the Cold War, 1989, called The Liberalism of Fear, you know, which became, you know, very widely, you know, cited and read and taught. And what impressed me about her first book, published in the 1950s was that she emerged as a kind of social democratic critic of the Cold War liberal political thought that was becoming hegemonic in her own era. And, you know, she voiced a lot of skepticism about various features of it. And I have always loved that first book of hers, After Utopia. And it seemed like an interesting opportunity, not just to give her more airtime than she usually gets, especially this earliest phase in her career, but to see how she developed in her first book a kind of multifaceted critique of the war liberals. And so it's for that reason that I not only introduce her and give her her own chapter, the first, but also kind of return to her across the book, because she seems as if she was a had some insights into what everyone else embracing Cold War liberalism before her was doing. And so that's the kind of, you know, conceit of the book, that she's the muse and she's, you know, constantly present. And I not only call on her powers as you do with muses, but you kind of keep that kind of, you know, commentator constantly in the frame.
You constantly bring her back up throughout the book, kind of taking some of her early ideas and playing them against the other ideas that that you look at. But, you know, what is the sort of, in your view, the essence of Sklar's worry about how liberalism was transforming in this post-World War II period?
She makes an allegation that liberals are reaching the last stage of their historic abandonment of the Enlightenment with its promise to emancipate our agency and our powers. Now, I'm a little bit in tension with Sklar because, as I mentioned, like a more recent great analyst of the history of liberalism, Amanda Anderson, a literary critic, Sklar thought there were kind of long-term reasons why liberals got anxious and nervous about emancipation. Really, from the moment that the Jacobins begin playing with the fire of political modernity. But I do think what's of great and lasting value in Sklar's version of that argument is that she said whatever had occurred before World War II, the period after World War II led liberals to a kind of very extreme version of doubts that it's even worth emancipating human beings, because they'll likely just use that freedom to, you know, embrace tyranny. And she shows that even in this early period, when in practice liberals, even Cold War liberals, are building the biggest liberal states, the most redistributive liberal states that they ever have, Cold War liberal theorists were kind of overlapping to a substantial degree with early neoliberals like Friedrich Hayek. And she, even in the 1950s, writes this fascinating passage in her book that's about how the liberal abandonment of the Enlightenment was leading to too much similarity to those neoliberals, as they were already called. And so I'm very interested in that criticism, because I think it's proved, you know, more profound than she could have known at the time, since, of course, we now live in a neoliberal age, and we have to ask, how did we get from Cold War liberalism into it?
Yeah, so to bring in, you know, a bit of the second person that you profile, Isaiah Berlin, you look at different aspects of Berlin, but you also talk about how Berlin looked at romanticism, and this kind of, I guess you could call it like a political demonology, I think you use that term, to describe how people seem to blame, like Berlin in particular and others, but blame Rousseau, blame the French Revolution for the eventual, you know, totalitarian explosions of the 20th century. So I was wondering if you could explain that idea. Why is it that people would think that Rousseau or some thinkers from 100 years before would somehow be responsible for political activities that would happen much later.
So I could have taken up Isaiah Berlin because he, you know, seems to fall prey to Sklar's criticisms of Cold War liberalism. He ends up with a more or less libertarian approach to liberalism with his famous theory of negative liberty, and that puts him in proximity to Hayek and neoliberalism, even if Berlin was never a neoliberal. But in the second chapter, I thought, let me do something unexpected and find something to praise in his work, even against his one-time student, which Judith Sklar had been at Harvard in the 1950s. And what I single out is Berlin's rather floridly positive understanding of the political significance of romanticism in literature and philosophy. Now, for background, you know, the first half of this book in general is about how Cold War liberals get rid of a lot of liberal sources. I've already mentioned the Enlightenment. But they also scapegoated romanticism, often seen as the opposite of the Enlightenment, as the source of 20th century totalitarianism. The most obvious person who did so was an Israeli author named Jacob Talmon, author of one of the most significant Cold War tracts called The Origins of Totalitarian Democracy. And even Sklar in her book After Utopia is pretty negative about romanticism. She doesn't blame romanticism for leading to totalitarianism, but she does say it led people to withdraw from politics and gave them no resources to kind of combat totalitarianism in the name of emancipation. So Berlin takes a totally different view, even though he's kind of a charter member of Cold War liberal political thought. He says that liberalism emerges in alliance with romanticism. Of course, he's completely right about this. If we think back to John Stuart Mill, who's On Liberty is so different from 20th century defenses of liberalism because it's a theory of society as the production of creative individuality. That's the reason why freedom should be endorsed, not as a first order value, but as something that will enable self-invention and collective self-invention. And there are lots of other examples. Benjamin Constant, the Swiss liberal of approximately the same era as Mill, also a romantic. Alexis de Tocqueville, also a romantic. And one of Berlin's greatest essays is about Mill and says, you know, there's this tension because what if limiting the state as Mill proposes in On Liberty, doesn't actually do enough to promote individuality. What then? Mill would have to choose between, let's say, his libertarianism and his romanticism. And my suggestion is that Berlin was talking about the past of liberalism, but he was also talking about himself and the choice he had made, notwithstanding his admiration for romanticism's really transformation of our whole sense of what our lives are about, and the kind of politics of Cold War liberalism that Berlin embraced, precisely in saying, if we say government has a role in the production of the circumstances of individuality, it will use that theory of positive liberty, so-called, too, as an alibi for totalitarianism. But Berlin clearly felt that this was, you know, at least something that had a hold over him, too, even as he became much more famous, not as someone who saved romanticism from Cold War liberal scorn, but called for negative liberty. So I try to use him kind of against type, if you like, to remind us how much was at stake in the deaccessioning of these old sources for liberals, which Jean-Jacques Rousseau had been, which the French Revolution, a great inspiration for liberalism, had been, and then Romanticism as this extraordinary development, which imposes on all of us to this day a kind of imperative to be creative and new with our lives, which is a high liberal calling.
The next person that you discuss is Karl Popper, and you don't look at his scientific philosophy of science. You look at his views on history and politics. And I would say this is the section where you're probably most critical, where, you know, with Sklar in Berlin, and then even with the other people that you discuss, you know, you really try and, maybe not a perfect balance necessarily, but you really try and find, look at the, you know, highlight the nuances. But with Popper, I would say that you really have a lot of negative things to say. So what is it about Popper that maybe pisses you off is the wrong term, but what is that Popper that frustrates you?
I think irritation, you know, frustration are good words. And maybe, you know, I let those get the better of me because I did want to, you know, as most historians should be, you know, try to understand people and their times and grasp what they're doing, even if, you know, those, you know, past actors couldn't foresee the consequences of their work. I think maybe my rhetoric is not as you know, as polished in that chapter, but I in a sense do have a lot of admiration for the not just the philosophy of science that Popper pioneered, but also his attempt to impose it on history and politics. What I try to say is that there were just some great ironies in what otherwise seem like pretty unexceptionable arguments he makes against thinking of history as having regularities of the kind that natural scientists find in nature. One was that he really did set out to save socialism. I try to show that he had been a socialist in his youth in Austria and really was himself irritated and frustrated with the Austro-Marxist under whose rule he lived in interwar Vienna, and who I think he unfairly blamed for the victory first of the Christian right and then eventually the National Socialists in his city. I do think it was unfair of him to kind of scapegoat those socialists as if they were to blame for the victory of the far right, let alone for Adolf Hitler's, you know, expansionism. But it's still important that he is a leftist at the start and really thinks of himself as trying to provide some correctives for socialism. But of course, in the end, becomes a Cold War liberal and quite a conservative one by the end of his life. Part of the reason I try to show is that once again, like Berlin, he, in a series of steps, enters into proximity with neoliberalism. And fair enough, since Hayek got him a job at the London School of Economics and saved him from what Popper thought was exile in New Zealand, where he wrote his major political works like The Open Society and Its Enemies, and which he thought of as, you know, just, you know, an intolerable place. But you know, he became an early member of the Montpellier Society and so forth. But then there's the second, you know, kind of unintended consequence of Popper's work, which is that, you know, he is so hostile towards what he calls historicism, the idea that there are laws and history, that he ends up, just as other liberals were, you know, scapegoating the Enlightenment or Romanticism along with, you know, Rousseau and the French Revolution for totalitarianism. You know, Popper and his critique of historicism helped make another philosopher, G.W.F. Hegel, as well as Karl Marx, kind of radioactive for liberals. Now, this was disastrous, I try to suggest, because liberals had believed in history as a form of opportunity for liberalism. And so Hegel may not have been a liberal personally, but liberals often became Hegelians. And as the 19th century passed, they learned a lot from Marx, especially Marx's critique of a merely formal or legal freedom. And liberals eventually got the memo that they too need to make freedoms real and social. And that's what, of course, they were trying to do in Popper's own period when they were building welfare states, you know, belatedly after the ravages of their, you know, misalliance with 19th century capitalism. And so I wouldn't say Popper is exactly to blame, but he's symbolic for me of a liberal renunciation of history as a forum of progressive opportunity for liberalism, merely because the Soviets also famously made claims on it in saying things about how history guaranteed, you know, the coming of you know, revolution and communism. And so maybe I went a little overboard, but I think Popper is useful to kind of get at this last deaccessioning that Cold War liberals engage in, which leads them to give us a form of liberalism that's just radically different than what's come before.
To what extent do you think pointing the finger at Hegel at this period of time was a matter of just his German heritage and the fact that the enemy was German? And then also at the same time with Marx too, that, oh, well, the Soviets are claiming, you know, that they have this progressive history. You know, do you think that it was hard for them to kind of actually read these authors on their own terms?
Absolutely. I mean, it's remained hard, really. You know, before World War One, when Hegel really gets, you know, marginalized in Anglo-American thought, Hegel was a central resource for 19th century Americans and Britons. And Marx, you know, I think was too. I mean, I think Marx was less affected by just being German, but certainly the fact that the Soviets understandably claimed him meant that he increasingly became off limits. And the roots of tyranny were then, you know, ascribed to Marx's thought rather than seeing it as something that could help liberalism avoid its own mistakes. So I take your point that it's understandable what happened, but we also have to register the long-term, I think, you know, more or less catastrophic effects intellectually. And the way I try to put this in, you know, what I think of as one of the more important passages of the book is looking after 1989. When, of course, Francis Fukuyama, a kind of right-wing Hegelian, declares that, you know, Hegel's was correct, but insofar as we're done now. Whereas a lot of liberals sort of greet the end of history, as Fukuyama did, with a kind of, you know, sense of melancholy, that they've been deprived through their own actions of any sense of fulfillment of liberal ideals themselves in history. And I think, you know, it's not like Popper is exactly to blame for that, but he helps, I hope, you know, symbolize that process of abandonment of history as a setting.
Yeah, I think that really comes through in that chapter. Moving to the next person, because I think, you know, once we sort of talk about the different characters in the book, then it'll be easier to kind of look at some of the bigger picture notions around Cold War liberalism that you get at, especially with the last chapter that kind of brings us up to date. But you talk about someone who, you know, I think doesn't get enough attention, Gertrude Himmelfarb, who's really is such a fascinating figure. And you look at her kind of reading of Lord Acton and the kind of reviving of him in this period of him kind of being a sort of a saint of Cold War liberalism. So sort of you could introduce, you know, people might have been familiar with Popper in Berlin, but, you know, for those who don't know, who is Gertrude Himmelfarb and why did you include her in this chapter?
Well, Gertrude Himmelfarb is unfortunately not as well known as her husband, Irving Kristol, or for that matter, son, Bill Kristol. And yet, I think she deserves the most credit for inventing neoconservative thought. And I try to kind of turn to her, not just to rectify kind of the wrong of consigning her to the margin, but also because it's crucial that she comes out of Cold War liberalism. And so just as it's an anteroom to neoliberalism, it also proved for her and I think others an anteroom to neoconservatism. But there are also other reasons why she's of great importance to the book. One is that she helps highlight the importance of religion in general and Christianity in particular to Cold War liberalism and a particular Augustinian form of Christianity. Even as, you know, she helps begin to think about what to say about the fact that essentially all the Cold War liberals, certainly in this book, are Jewish by background. And so I try to introduce the edgy argument that we should think even of Jewish Cold War liberals as much more interested in Christianity than they were either in Judaism, Jewish experience, or secular liberalism, which prevailed in the
19th century. And what is it about Christianity? They're all, for the most part, they are maybe non-practicing Jews is the way to describe it. I think Popper was baptized Lutheran. But, you know, yeah, if you could just talk a little bit more about that, about these, you know, kind of secularized Jews and their turn towards Christianity and towards Cold War liberalism.
The back half of the book in general is about, you know, new sources to for liberals to rely upon once they've purged the emancipatory sources of liberalism from their tradition. And Lord Acton is a fascinating example, you know, peripheral in his time as an Anglo-German liberal Catholic, but an Augustinian one. And yet extremely useful, as you said, to a range of people in the 1940s, including, once again, Hayek, who planned to call the Maupertuis Society the Acton-Tocqueville Society before he was convinced not to do so. So, I mean, mainly I try to show that people like Himmelfarb, as well as her husband, you know, think that the more Hegelian and progressivist liberalism they've inherited, it needs to be overturned, and that the Augustinian perspective, which emphasizes original sin, is a fascinating and useful device to impose limits on human ambition, even if you don't have religious reasons to do so. If you think that, you know, calling for freedom and equality will lead liberalism to become communism, then you just want limits on the amount of freedom and equality that people should strive for, even when, if they're liberals of any kind, they say, you know, freedom is important to some extent. And so this Augustinian sense of sin that Himmelfarb dramatizes is a way of saying this liberalism should be a liberalism of fear of the Lord. If we insist that Christianity, this form of it, has political uses, then it's something that even secular Jews can celebrate. I say in the book that, you know, Hannah Arendt at one point kind of quipped that Orthodox Judaism was the Judaism she didn't practice. And I try to add to her joke that Orthodox Christianity, neo-Orthodox Christianity of Acton's sort, was the political religion that Cold War liberals wanted to see everyone else embrace, because it would save them allegedly from tyranny and totalitarianism.
And is this that, you know, liberalism of fear that you see embodied in Himmelfarb, is this similar to what Sklar would later embrace, or different?
Well, you know, using that phrase, I'm trying to troll Sklar, because Sklar herself was incredibly secular throughout her life. And I even show that in After Utopia, she was very dubious about the religious turn of Cold War liberals and others in her youth. And yet, it seems to me that Shklar could have seen, as she became a Cold War liberal herself, that taking on board the ambiance of anxiety and fear about the risk of tyranny and totalitarianism and the need to organize liberalism in light of, you know, human depravity, in a sense embraces, you know, in secular terms, some of the Augustinian premises that Himmelfarb called for. So I think there's an overlap at best, and I think I'd have to spell that out. It's a great question for that reason. But if the book is really about how the 19th century liberalism of hope was overthrown in the middle of the 20th century in the name of a liberalism of fear, which remains so prominent in our lifetimes, well, then the Christian moment in that transition seems absolutely pivotal, no matter whether any of its heirs later kind of understand where they're getting this liberalism of fear from.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
A person that you next profile in this, Hannah Arendt, if I remember correctly, she never really ever identified as a liberal. She, you know, at various points of time identified as a radical, and then you know, maybe never called herself a conservative, but sort of became conservative-esque. You know, what was Hannah Arendt's contribution, in your view, to Cold War liberalism as someone that might not have actually identified with that that name?
I have a kind of a few reasons for selecting her for attention. I mean, tongue in cheek, I call her a kind of fellow traveler of Cold War liberalism. Even if she wasn't one herself, she adopted a lot of the views of Cold War liberalism. Of course, she was responsible for the, you know, enormous rise of the theory of totalitarianism, which was basically a Cold War liberal project, even if she, you know, forged her own idiosyncratic version. But if you look at her own understanding of the history of philosophy, although there's, of course, a lot of originality in her thinking about the Greeks and so forth, and Romans especially, she also kind of concurred with the Cold War liberals on what to get rid of from the canon, like Rousseau, like the French Revolution, which she really demonized, like Hegel. And so there's that first reason that I think we need to recognize much more than we have, and in a kind of more celebratory mode around Arendt, just how indentured she was to the implausible outlook of the Cold War liberals, even not kind of consenting to be one. And then there is, I think, the use she provides in thinking about two related topics in Cold War liberalism. One is the fact that Cold War liberals essentially have nothing to say about decolonization, you know, the most emancipatory moment maybe ever, and in a certain sense, a moment of the last gasp of 19th century liberal emancipation, which with which these Cold Warriors couldn't identify. And Arendt is really useful because she doesn't pass over decolonization in silence. She actively stigmatizes it in On Revolution, which I think is one of her great books, but also one that's, you know, kind of really about the French Revolution's legacy and the decolonization of the world. And then I also think she's useful, I try to argue, to continue thinking about the Cold War liberals as Jews, but Jews who, if they had a Jewish element to their thought, it was a Zionist element. And of course, famously, Arendt was very briefly a Zionist in the later 1930s and early 1940s, but argued in a sense for decolonization before its time, including armed struggle and not exactly national emancipation, but certainly a kind of decolonization of the British Empire. And the Cold War liberals were much more permanently Zionist. Berlin was, Talmon was. And it's as if they make an exemption for Israel, which is a site of, you know, armed struggle for decolonization and national emancipation, from their otherwise withering verdict about 19th century liberalism. And so I think she's useful in getting at some things that the Cold War liberals didn't always directly say about the nature of their position.
Yeah, I think that particular argument is really really powerful in the book, just kind of highlighting that the sort of exception that proves the rule, that this is the instance where the 19th century liberalism with emancipatory violence and with the optimism, this is where it's acceptable. But in these other cases, no, this is where we need to have a kind of almost a conservative, you know, Burkean style approach to it. Just to kind of round out the people that you cover, the last intellectual biography you look at is Lionel Trilling. And, you know, just to sort of seal it with all the people that you look at, what is Lionel Trilling's contribution to Cold War liberalism in your view?
Well, so if I'm a little unfair to Popper, I think I just emerged from my reading kind of enamored with Trilling, and I found it really hard to dislike him, because I think he was incredibly subtle, so the kind of official point of the chapter about him, which concludes the book, is mainly, I think, to give a sense of how not just sin, but in a secular guise, Sigmund Freud's account of human aggression could serve Cold War liberals. And Trilling is incredibly interesting because he works really hard to develop a reading of psychoanalysis that has approximately the same function as Himmelfarb's Augustinian theory, because the point is to say we should give up on emancipation because human beings aren't up for it. They're not just libidinal, but they're evil, just now in a kind of secular framework that emphasizes Freud's so-called death drive. But what I try to show is that Trilling is, you know, a little more interesting than just adding a new source for liberalism and psychoanalysis, because he's very mournful in his creation of Cold War liberalism. And I try to show that he, in a sense, also never really gives up on 19th century liberalism, which had led him in the 30s to be a fellow traveler, something he never really gets over. Because in his mature period, when he writes the essays that become The Liberal Imagination, a huge bestseller of the Cold War, he is very open about the costs of renunciation of the past liberal optimism. And much of his work, I think, can be read as a kind of retrospective act of mourning the very creation of Cold War liberalism that continues to make Trilling famous in many quarters.
You mentioned a little bit that part of what was interesting about Cold War liberalism as a topic is that it kind of was this bridge towards certain interesting successor ideologies. What do you see as the kind of relationship between Cold War liberalism and neoliberalism and neoconservatism? Do you think that neoliberalism and neoconservatism are logical outgrowths, or were they paths taken, that were highly contingent on multitude of factors?
I think that Cold War liberalism stands on its own, but it seems as if its propensity to devolve into other things means it's fragile and unstable. And so, of course, it could be that people can hew to it permanently. I mean, Isaiah Berlin basically did. They can revive it, as many people have done in various circumstances. But my hope is that the book illustrates that it's not exactly contingent that it has this potential to degrade into other things. And I think that's, you know, as I began thinking about it, it seemed to me a really important way of thinking about ideologies. Some are relatively more stable, some are relatively less stable. And so it's not going to be good enough to say, well, there's a distinction between one ideology and another if the first predictably for many of its votaries devolves into these successor movements. So, you know, the main point of the book is still that the Cold War liberals changed liberalism. Trilling, you know, has been haunted by allegations that, well, he would have become a neoconservative, his students did, et cetera. And that somehow matters less to me than what he did to liberalism, that he mourned his own accomplishment in a certain way. But it also matters, you know, given how much water there is under the bridge since this period, that we've seen these successor movements arise, and that couldn't have happened, I believe, out of the earlier forms of liberalism. So we should care both about Cold War liberalism in its own right and for what it could become.
Liberalism for the past 10 years, you know, maybe even a little longer, has gone through a really tumultuous period where many people are saying that maybe it's time to leave liberalism behind. There are, you know, people mostly on the right, but some on the left, who refer to themselves as post-liberals. Yet it seems like you want to hold on to liberalism, or rather you want to go and resuscitate some of the ideas of liberalism that the Cold War liberals cut off. So, you know, my question is, you know, in the epilogue, you call it Why Cold War Liberalism Keeps Failing, which to me seems like a reference to Patrick Deneen's book, Why Liberalism Failed. So, you know, what is your, you know, argument to Patrick Deneen about why, yes, liberalism, Cold War liberalism failed, but, you know, liberalism isn't all that bad, or there's aspects of liberalism. What do you want to preserve?
Well, so, I mean, this book is very much, you know, it began as a response to Pat Deneen and really the moment after 2016 when people began to say, especially on the right, but also sometimes on the left, that liberalism, its bankruptcy is proven by populism or whatever, and we need some successor ideology. And I actually reviewed Deneen's book when it came out, and, you know, my sense is that while, you know, it takes a view of liberalism that says it's 500 years old and stands or falls as a kind of civilizational block that's working itself pure in our times, that, you know, the historian in me revolts against these kinds of grand statements, since we know that liberals don't even have a self-conscious sense of themselves as liberals until after the French Revolution. And of course, their liberalism was so different than when the Cold War mutated it and it began to decline into the kinds of neoconservatism and neoliberalism that Deneen and others of that ilk are actually very, very firm ground to condemn. And so I don't think we have a credible form of liberalism just to exhume from the past, but that doesn't mean there aren't elements of liberalism that we would want to harness and rehabilitate and work into a new package. It may not matter whether it ends up being called liberalism, as long as we can rescue the liberal commitment, as Schlar saw it, to the emancipation of our agency, to creative agency in particular, along romantic lines, to a sense of possibility in historical time. And so my response is not kind of either exonerating of liberalism for its mistakes, nor kind of just wants to sweep it away. I think we have to be more discriminating than that. And it's in that spirit that the book tries to lay out a critique of Deneen implicitly that says, in every moment we have parts of the past that are credible enough to try to work into something that is more credible than anything we've seen today.
You still want to hold on to it maybe for a little while longer, that there still is something about liberalism that is maybe worth preserving or at least worth rediscovering for the purpose of finding something new. If would that be accurate to say?
That's essentially it. I mean, you know, I think at the present moment in the place we are, you know, there's a reason to think that, you know, the notion of liberalism has some meaning to people. But we don't have to stick with that label if we find a better label. So I'm not against post-liberalism as a rhetorical matter, because it's essential to call out liberal mistakes, you know, past and present. At the same time, even if you read Deneen closely, he's for preserving certain aspects of liberalism. And so it requires us to think about what we're going to propose, not only what to label it. And whatever we propose ought to have liberal features, the right ones and not the wrong ones.
How did you decide to write this book in the wake of Humane? Were these sort of two separate projects, or was this was this something that you had been thinking about that you thought was a project? Like, are you gonna you know, maybe go back to writing about current events again, or not so sure?
Well, there's always the temptation in life to engage in retconning, and I can do it with the best of them and explain how there's unity to the seemingly random choices I've made. But I did want to get out of a kind of 10-year period of writing about a certain narrow set of things, kind of liberalism in international politics and in particular legal liberalism in international politics. And so I thought it would be a way of keeping some consistency, while, you know, also trying to return to some roots I feared losing, you know, in intellectual history, and also focusing on some events of and debates of my time that have just like evolved beyond whatever motive made me to think about human rights and humanitarian law in the 90s. We're just at a very different moment when, as you say, liberalism is under siege. And I think it's an opportunity not to circle the wagons, but to see what's, you know, plausible about that siege, but also how we can, you know, respond more creatively than past moments when liberals have seen themselves threatened.
Yeah, I mean, I think the approach that you took, I'm glad that you circled back to writing about intellectual history. I think that was a great decision. And also, I think that, you know, you offer things in here that are a much better response than the kind of the normal, arguments or responses to someone like Deneen, which are basically like, oh, what, liberalism is great. You know, we're still on this path towards progressive history. Shut up and don't argue with liberalism's forward march. Instead of responding to, you know, great criticisms that people, you know, recently have been bringing up. Well, once again, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. It was really great speaking with you.